Hi, I'm Nikhil Abraham, co-founder and CEO of CloudShift, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, "Trust me, I know what I'm doing." Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, a conversation with the co-founder and CEO of CloudChef, Nikhil Abraham. Stay tuned. So once again, thank you so much for listening to this and sharing it with your friends and family, for rating and reviewing it wherever you're listening, and for following Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing on all that social media. So I ask you this. If imitation is the highest form of flattery, then what exactly then is recreation? Master artists are out there right now expressing themselves through music and dance and written word and all kinds of performance, with students and observers out there who will undoubtedly try and emulate and get closer to mastery. Surely, if you also now add in AI and machine learning models into this, this process can get accelerated, deepened, and definitely push a lot of boundaries. Now, what if the artistic substrate that's being recreated is a basic human need, like food? Not just for the instant gratification, because if I could have a pav bhaji from Sarafa in Indore, or a chaha from a Dadar Mumbai Chaiwala, or a cheese slice at V&T's Pizza on the Upper West Side, I'd move the mountain to get that done. But also for the access and allowing for food experiences to be recreated anywhere and for anyone. So to help think about these questions, it was truly great to catch up with Nikhil Abraham, the co-founder and CEO of CloudChef. Nikhil is an IIT Bombay graduate and now lives in Palo Alto, California. Now he's a music lover, and just like you can search and experience and download music from a worldwide catalog on Spotify or Apple Music or Amazon, Nikhil started asking the question of how to exactly do this with food. In 2018, he co-founded CloudChef and now also serves as CEO. His vision is to enable consumers to redefine culinary boundaries by taking signature delicious food by any chef from across the world and have that meal recreated locally. CloudChef uses AI to codify recipes from any chef and reproduce them in their cooking facilities using both software automation and humans in a cobotic way to execute the outcome. So far, the concentration has been on Indian food, with award-winning high-profile chefs and culinary experts as investors. But the hope is to eventually scale to a variety of cuisines and options. CloudChef has brought to life over 200,000 meals so far, and the concept has forced creating new frameworks around things like chef royalties and new distribution models for scaling and even redefining recipe ownership. And while the first layer of intrigue is experiencing a signature dish from a renowned chef delivered right to your door, the second layer may be recreating your own family's signature dish and automating it at scale. So I was fortunate enough to catch up with Nikhil, and in fact we met at Copra, the new San Francisco restaurant of Michelin award-winning chef Sri Gopinathan, who was a previous guest on the podcast and now a CloudChef creator. Nikhil and I chatted about everything from nostalgia to a new era of the food experience to lessons learned, but we started out importantly by talking about whether the art of food should get measured by purity.
Does art get measured by purity? Honestly, I don't know. That's my answer to it. We take a slightly different path for that at CloudChef. At what we do at CloudChef, we get to see a lot of chefs who are like artists and different types of chefs. And the more I see, the more I don't know. So, right.
I mean, it's a strange abstract question in that way. Yeah. But I think the reason I ask it is, you know, when the authenticity of something, the purity of art and creation, versus something that gets diluted, and even for that matter, reproduced. Some people will tell you that, you know, they played a piece of music, mm-hmm. they themselves composed it or they created it, but every single time they play it, it's a little bit different and there's some nuance to it. And is any iteration of that any less pure? And we as consumers or listeners, whether it's music or whether it's food, Are we measuring our experience by that purity? Is kind of like the, and I don't know if I know the answer either, but mm-hmm. but that's where that question goes. When have you had to deal with this question when it comes to, you know, design and thinking about the product that you're actually trying to give and deliver to consumers?
To me, I mean, I don't think of purity as the first thing I think of. Like, is it giving me joy? Is it like helping me connect to some earlier feelings that I had? Is it invoking nostalgia in me? Is it like just engaging me with humor? And more than purity, like, increasingly what I'm enjoying with art is authenticity, in the sense that there isn't too much makeup put on the art. There's more substance than storytelling, which is what I'm largely leaning towards when my own personal consumption. But I think that's also partly affected by the fact that you're running a startup and you have to build a product, and you have to build products fast, and you have to ship
things
fast.
They have something out there.
Yeah, you have to ship things fast. You have to get inside. You have to make things, and you have to see if it works.
Yeah.
And in that process, you pretty much have to focus directly on the meat of the problem.
Right.
But then that's not so. There are artistic decisions that are being made there.
Yeah.
And that's actually counterintuitive to people who haven't seen the building process itself.
Sure.
And it's a struggle, because when you are actually in the process of making something, you want it to be perfect. You want it to be the truest representation of what you thought should exist out there.
Right.
But
it doesn't
most,
always go that way.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't always go that way. And from a consumption perspective, for me, it was more based on the sense that is this content authentic? Like, is this person acting, or is this actually authentic? Because now we are able to consume from anywhere in the world. So we have more than 200 million content creators competing for our attention.
Yeah.
Now, with so many people competing for our attention, I think authenticity is the key.
Yeah.
And being true to what they are, as compared to putting a facade of what something they aren't.
When you were conceptualizing this idea for
mm-hmm.
Cloud Chef, you kind of mentioned it before, but where did nostalgia come in as a, for a previous food experience? Where did that fall in?
Funnily, nostalgia is part of what pulled the trigger to start the company, and I'll get to that. So I had moved to the Bay Area early 2017. This was right after graduating from college, and I didn't really know how to cook well, and I was craving home food quite a lot.
Yeah.
In 2017, the Indian food scene in the Bay Area wasn't even as good as what it is today.
Sure.
And I was honestly missing food from home, and I would call my mom and my grandmom, and I'd figure out how to make this recipe, and I'd call my mom one day and I'd ask her, I really want to make this chicken curry that you're making at home, how do I do it? Then she'll try her best to convey this on video call, and I don't know if this is working out as well as you think it.
There's
well
something
as you,
missing.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously she knows how to cook way better than I do, and people who know how to cook are also not always the best at explaining it to people who don't know how to cook.
Yeah.
So basically this was happening, and my co-founder Atish at that point had moved from Bombay to Bangalore, and we were chatting one day, and we were
there's gotta be a way.
Yeah, man, the food in the Bay Area is not as good as I wanted.
Sure.
And I'm really missing high quality Indian food. And what he was saying was also, man, I really like Maharashtrian food, and the Maharashtrian food in Bangalore is not great.
Right.
And you're okay, if only robots knew how to make food, we would all have tasty food, and we would all be able to have what we want to have. But obviously robots aren't there, and robots don't know how to make food.
Yeah.
Then you're okay, so what it actually means is, in the same way that you can record and playback audio and video, you cannot record and playback taste.
Yep.
So what does it mean to record and playback taste? So we started diving into that, and the first set of like pushback and the first set of feedback that we got on this was that, okay, cooking is an art. How do you how do you codify an art form? How do you take into account all these nuanced things that a chef looks at? Because a chef at the end of the day, at every single day, is giving a performance. He or she inside the kitchen, that's a full-blown 3-hour performance of which you get a piece out of. How is that even possible? And the thing is, there have been a lot of casualties on this road where people have said that we will automate food, and like, there's plenty of casualty along that way. So we were of the, initially we were of the opinion that it seemed like coming up with recipes is an art, and
which unto itself plays into the entire nostalgia conversation.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. So recipes in itself is art, but recreating them is most likely a science. And then the question is, to recreate recipes really accurately, what level of technology is required?
Yeah.
And how do you make sure that somebody sitting in some remote part of the world can have access to all their favorite foods, be it their favorite restaurant from Paris or your grandmother halfway across the world?
It brings to mind, you know, people who study golf swings,
mm-hmm.
and they have analytics and they have beautiful sensors and technology, and yet at the end you're hitting a golf ball.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike being able to taste pav bhaji or
right.
or some other, you know, cuisine, where the outcome is completely, again, based upon subjectivity, nostalgia, memory, experience, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in that same way, in thinking about how do you solve this problem, have you found that at least in this journey that you're solving the nostalgia piece?
I mean, at least to me, a lot of my nostalgia is being fulfilled through this, because I'm right now sitting in Palo Alto, able to have food from my mom, who's sitting
right.
in Kerala,
sure.
and has never stepped foot in the US, and it tastes exactly like home.
Yeah.
So
okay.
But again, like, that's an experience that we have for ourselves.
Completely.
And what we have been able to do is, however, get a chef to cook their recipe once in one of our kitchens.
Yeah.
There is a variety of sensors that are looking at the cooking process, from cameras to like real-time weight loss to infrared sensors to a bunch of other things.
Sure.
And the idea is to use all of this to break this recipe down into like thousands of data points,
yeah.
which can then help us recreate this recipe somewhere else in the world,
yeah.
where the ingredients might be slightly different. So, for example, tomatoes in the US are very different from tomatoes in India.
Sure.
Onions in the US take significantly longer to caramelize than onions in
yeah.
India. So our whole premise was that, can we use all the sensor information and codify all of what makes the recipe unique, so that this recipe can be recreated anywhere else in the world
yeah.
without the creator chef in the loop?
Yeah.
And for us, that was like the first big step towards record and playback taste, because if any recipe from any chef can be recreated anywhere else in the world, and a consumer sitting someplace else can eat food from any chef, that means that suddenly, like, what it means to be a chef and what it means to be an artist inside this changes completely. So, like, Chef Sri, whose restaurant we are sitting in right
yeah.
now, he's a 2-Michelin-star chef. So we started with very simple things. So we started by analyzing things like, okay, can you make Maggi noodles?
Mm-hmm.
So can you make instant 2-minute Maggi noodles
yeah.
consistently every
yeah.
single time? And then, okay, that's easy. Let's
right.
let's do tea. So
yeah.
can so we got this roadside chaiwala from Dadar. So this is all in Mumbai. We got him to come to our kitchen. We got him.
By the way, if you can recreate a Dadar chaha experience, I am sold already. But you know, even with this, is that what consumers need? Is
mm-hmm.
Is the premise in some ways also that, you know, consumers need that experience? You just described something that for me means a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to be able to recreate a Jaiwala experience, a Jaiwala experience, a Banwala experience, a, good, you know, a Maggi noodle experience, as simplistic as that might be, but given it, it's from someone else's hand. Mm-hmm. Is that what the consumer is basically looking for here?
So that's an interesting question, because and it's also a layered question in the sense that there are different segments of consumers looking at different things.
Yeah.
If you take a step back and think of what food is to people or people's relations with relation with food, food is joy, food is comfort, food is medicine.
Yeah.
Food is in fact a very central part of our daily experience, and because of that, people come to food for different things. So somebody coming for joy is possibly just looking for the tastiest foods that they can get their hands on.
Yeah.
Somebody who's coming for nostalgia is looking for a very specific experience, or they find a very specific experience and that triggers their nostalgia. Like, food is medicine. For people who are looking at food as medicine, they're looking for the optimum between the amount of calories I consume to the larger macro goals I have.
Yeah.
To given all of this, what is the best tasting thing that I can
eat?
Of course.
Yeah.
So given all of these constraints, there exist different brands that service these use cases, and what we want to do is, instead of, so like I said earlier, like, there are more than 200 million content creators competing,
yeah,
for your attention,
yeah,
and what, less than a handful of restaurants competing for a spot at your dinner table.
Right.
So we want to get all the world's best chefs and restaurants and creators and YouTubers and like recipe books to be able to sell those recipes as cooked food to consumers anywhere in the world. And then for you and me as consumers, we should be selecting, or we should be able to select from the best Indian restaurant, if we want Indian food,
sure,
the top Indian chefs and restaurants who cater to that need.
Yeah.
So for any consumer need, we basically want to enable you to have the best experience possible through aggregating the best recipes or the most iconic recipes from chefs and creators across the world.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Nikhil Abraham. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Congressman Ro Khanna, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation with the co-founder and CEO of Cloud Chef, Nikhil Abraham.
In some ways, I mean, the ease of discovery and the availability and the access is one thing. Does this in some ways minimize effectively the learning process and the discovery process itself in some ways, not just finding the food, but in trying to attempt to create the food, the power of actually making those mistakes,
mm-hmm,
and then therefore creating new styles of food.
Mm-hmm.
There is some joy in that as well. But on the other hand, it doesn't substitute the access that you get immediately to,
right,
that kind of food experience.
Right. So how I think about this is, if you look at anyone who's cooking food for themselves, some portion of those cooking hours that you do are solely for your artistic pleasure.
Right.
The other is just chore. I mean, like, you want food and you...
I want it and I'm not being able to reproduce it.
Exactly. Like, I want food. I just want something to eat.
Yeah.
You're mostly cooking at home because you trust your ingredients,
sure,
or you are looking for something specific that restaurants aren't able to get to you, or DoorDash,
sure,
isn't able to get to you. And I think cooking as artistic pleasure, I don't see a reason why people will not do it. I think if if anything, in a world where anybody has access to anything, you could make the case that this would be a faster creative process, or you would evolve faster, where again, there are more recipes than atoms in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, the possibilities are in some ways endless. And I mean, it kind of makes me think of another thought, which is, you know, the idea of the Spotify model, where mm-hmm. I'm discovering things, I craft a playlist, but there's also music that I've never heard before that's out there. And so if I theoretically wanted to create a hybrid dish of Shree's
mm-hmm.
and also in the style of Thomas Keller's at the mm-hmm. French Laundry,
mm-hmm.
almost like a melded playlist
mm-hmm.
Of their best dishes and that experience, I theoretically could, and for that matter, I theoretically should.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, that's directed by what I want to do in my kitchen, because I can't get that someplace else.
Correct.
But, you know, using the power of your model, is that the direction of creativity and user choice that you're hoping for?
So, in terms of creativity, I think, like you said, the possibilities are endless. But the possibilities are endless is also like a open-ended statement. The possibilities are so endless that, like I said, there are more recipes possible than... There are more unique, tasty recipes possible than there are atoms in the universe.
Right.
And as humanity, over the last thousands of years, we've maybe uncovered like 10 million, 15 million of these unique recipes ourselves. So what we want to do is, if now everything from anywhere in the world can be accessible, what are chefs going to do? Like, chefs are very creative people. I mean, they've been creating recipes that other people haven't looked at by taking very complex insights from the world as to what people want, what kind of flavors are working,
sure.
what kind of meats are
available.
A whole host of things, from culinary to consumer to location, that chefs look at. Once everything from the world gets accessible, I think what chefs will also end up doing is showing us a whole new set of recipes that kind of existed in their brains or were semi-formed thoughts that now they have to get out and be full-formed thoughts. You will also see stuff like chefs banding together, or AI banding chefs together.
Sure.
So, a Chef Sri / Thomas Keller might be a fantastic collab.
Yeah. I mean, in that way, I just made that up, but but I'm sure somebody would want to make that up in that way too, because of the kind of democratization of that combination. I mean, this is fantastic for creators in some ways, right? Because those who are the folks who have, you know, the name or the brand, and those who are perhaps still needing a distribution network or a distribution model, people wanting to scale their food or people wanting to scale the experience for others to enjoy, does it limit the exclusivity sometimes
mm-hmm.
of that experience? You know, so, you know, if I wanted to have that experience at the French Laundry right now,
mm-hmm.
it's not something I could dial up and order for my... It takes quite a bit of money. There's some barriers to that. And
mm-hmm.
maybe those barriers are there on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
How, in your eyes, is that a good thing to reduce those barriers? And is it a good thing for those creators, perhaps, who've built up through so much time and effort and you know, real toil to,
mm-hmm.
in some ways, create those barriers?
I mean,
I hope that makes sense, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it makes total sense.
Yeah.
So the way I would think about it today is realistically, there is only a couple of ways a restaurant can signal that they're high value today. And the reason for that is it's very hard for Thomas Keller to open up French Laundry to someplace else, because there's just so much that's going around in the background. He's physically required there most of the time.
Sure.
And if you are, as a chef, or so the popular narrative with food is that the more scale you have, the worse your taste is, or the worse the experience is.
Right.
And that food is anti-scale narrative over many, many years has gotten into consumer psyche as well.
Yeah.
What that also means is, now if you're a very iconic restaurant or an iconic chef, you would only be able to serve so many people every single night. The upside to that is that your place is always full. You don't have to worry about demand. You just need to make sure that the kitchen works and everything else.
Yeah.
Everything else falls into place because people are already creating a line up front.
Yeah.
What it also does is it leaves a ton of value on the table.
Yeah.
To some degree, like, people in Bombay know about French Laundry.
Sure.
Like, people in Bangalore know about French Laundry. What percentage of them will eventually end up at Napa to go to French Laundry?
Right.
A very, very tiny percentage. So the amount of value that is left on the table, to me, feels like at least 1,000 or 10,000 times bigger than whatever credibility you could lose by being in multiple places. And I say credibility because, like I said, like, there is this consumer psyche that has come in that food that is made in multiple places is not as good as food made only in one place.
But to some degree, we get by that, right? By saying, hey, Thomas Keller's disciples or Sri's disciples who have now gone on to make their own restaurants, you know, that is something that we find to be credible, right?
Got it.
And there's some currency to that, that we say, okay, wow, they coming from this lineage, now we're going to okay that. And in some ways, I imagine that the question would be, what's the difference then between someone who is trying to reproduce it through their disciples or someone who's trying to actually reproduce that taste experience through a system like yours?
So that's what we are hopeful about as well.
Yeah.
And we've seen lesser resistance to this than we had thought initially.
Yeah.
Because today, if you look at the experience that we enable for consumers in Palo Alto, they are able to order food from, like, some of the most iconic Indian chefs from across India. So this includes, like, Thomas Zacharias, who used to run this place called the Bombay Canteen.
Bombay Cafe, right. Bombay Canteen, sure.
Canteen.
Yeah.
Chef Sri, who's a 2-Michelin-star chef. We have Butter Chicken from the inventors of Butter Chicken that's coming in. We have Dal Bukhara from Delhi.
Yeah.
That's also coming in. Now, the thing is, we initially thought we'll see some amount of skepticism, but the thing is, once somebody has an experience where they eat a dish that they have eaten before and it tastes the same, like, then we see the paradigm change completely in people's mind.
I wanted to ask you this. I mean, there's in some ways value to the variability sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I have pav bhaji in, you know, a market in Indore versus pav bhaji that my neighbor perhaps is making, you know, I hopefully am appreciating that variability at some point. And whether it's at a Michelin restaurant or a Michelin chef or a food truck, in some ways, though, the cloud chef model is to perhaps not reduce the variability of choice, but reduce the variability of production, and, you know, try and make it so that you can duplicate that chef's dish. And so I'm just curious how you reflect on that. If we try and crave variability in some of our food choices, yet, you know, we don't want variability when it comes to reproducing something. So is that a kind of creative tension that you have to grapple with?
We actually don't, we proactively don't take a stance on this. And our approach is that anybody with a recipe should be able to serve that recipe anywhere else.
Right.
The same with content. Are there similar content that say the same thing on social media? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is also, one, there's a bunch of the creation process is so democratized. With food, I would not say it's that democratized yet.
Yeah.
Because it still costs money to recreate these recipes. Somebody has to buy actual real ingredients as compared to just take their phone and
start creating.
And start creating a video. The cost to do that is way lesser as compared to the cost of serving food to But as and when we move closer and closer towards that point, this is what will end up happening. So you will have more and more variety on every single thing. Like, what is Pav Bhaji? Like, why do, like, 15 people want to sell you Pav Bhaji? Because they have some notion of why you will like Pav Bhaji, and they like feel strongly that this Pav Bhaji should be put in front of this consumer. And that's how most restaurants, like, I mean, like, even Chef Sri, he thinks that he wants to showcase his Kerala heritage by having a place here.
And for that matter, why not, right? I mean, and that's his creative vein that or path and lane that he's going down.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Nikhil Abraham. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Sigda Swar, the founder and CEO of The Juggernaut, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with the co-founder and CEO of Cloud Chef, Nikhil Abraham.
People talk in that way that, you know, Tree's a good example, right? He has the experience in the background and perhaps the instinct and intuition that he's developed in how he's been able to figure this out and that he's gained through learning. And then as a creator, you sort of develop a relationship with the food, with the people who are experiencing the work. How does relationship development fit into the product model? How does relationship development fit into what you're aiming to achieve when it comes to imagining what success is like for Cloud Chef?
In terms of relationship, there is one, the relationship between the creator and the consumer itself. Today, there are models that allow chefs to engage with their consumers. One is building a restaurant.
Right.
The other is, like one of the creators we work with, Chef Thomas, he has 150,000 followers on Instagram.
Sure, and like, social media.
Yeah, so like, if you have like 500,000 followers on social media, you have an engaged user base. You are talking to those engaged, you're talking to that engaged user base, but doing any sort of commerce to them, it's really hard because they are spread out globally. And if you're a chef and your social media presence is about being a chef and cooking food, you can't be selling like ExpressVPN or you can't. So there are creators of food who already have a pre-existing relationship with consumers through social media or through other channels that they can leverage. And I think that will set the way forward for the next set of creators who are figuring out what does it mean to really sell food.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't really changed over the last like many decades. So.
Well, but let me ask you one thing. Is it more important for the consumer to create or have a relationship with the creator and the chef or have a relationship with Cloud Chef?
So for us, we don't... So we think the creator's relation with the consumer stands higher than our relation with the consumer.
Sure.
And to that degree, like our website today is also like a creator platform. So creators come host their recipes. If you go to Sri's Instagram, you'll like see his link in bio to be cloudchef.co/atan.
Sure.
Or if you go to some of these creators, it's just that they don't really have a place to monetize and tell the story and also to aggregate all this goodness together. And we're just doing that.
Yeah.
And our goal is that people relate to creators or people, somebody will relate to some specific creator. They'll probably have more of their food, but eventually we'll end up trying other things on the platform or other chefs.
Are you then a marketplace for that? I mean, and with a marketplace, it's sort of a envelope for trust, right? That say, hey, look, I've sampled this before, it works for me, I've been able to, you know, have that experience, but that's the marketplace that I'm seeking.
Correct. So what we are underwriting as a marketplace is the fact that when a creator tells you that their food is available in this location on Cloud Chef and you see it on Cloud Chef, we guarantee you that this is the recipe from the creator recreated in a kitchen with all these processes followed and all this technology
sure.
in, and it tastes the same every single time. So our what we are trying to be is just this trust layer for the consumer
right.
and the creator that today, like, why isn't Sri available in like 500 locations in the US? I mean, there are plenty of people who are willing to franchise
sure.
this stuff.
Yeah.
It's just that it's very hard for them to underwrite their operations, or like, it's very risky for to do
if,
a food operation, because ultimately, if the food doesn't deliver or if the food doesn't stand up, you can have all the great ambience in the world, you
yeah.
can have all the great service, but if the food doesn't stand up, it's really
the
hard.
The content is still king.
Correct. So basically, content is still king over there.
Yeah.
And because content is still king and the execution is really key, we kind of act as this trust layer, saying that, look, if you've recorded your recipes with us, those recipes are going to be recreated in facilities that have all our tech.
How much of the trust layer also involves the leap to say, I'm going to allow a computer, I'm going to allow data to be a participle of that trust?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Was that something that even for you had to take that leap of faith to say that this is something I'm going to allow to be a part of that trust layer?
So, funnily, when we started, we had the first meeting of Cloud Chef. So, the three founders, we sat together and went to this place, Bombay Canteen.
Yeah.
We approached Chef Zach and we told him that, see, this is what we are doing. This is what we are planning to do. At that point, the larger theme was that we think that we can break down recipes using sensors and
sure.
then recreate those recipes elsewhere. We have no idea about everything else around it. We are just starting the company. Today's day one.
Yeah.
And his response is that, I don't think this is possible.
Right.
And part of that is also because there's a graveyard of startups here that
sure.
weren't able to do it. And unfortunately, the approach that most of them took was that of viewing the chef as a glorified timer.
Yes.
Yeah. And not all this complex data that a chef is looking at.
Sure.
And that doesn't work because, I mean, like I said, if you saute onions for 5 minutes today, they might get burnt. But if you saute
right.
them for 5 minutes, 2 weeks later, they'll probably they won't be brown. We initially had a tough time just even getting like chefs on board with the idea that, okay, their recipes can be recreated
yeah.
using data. And then eventually, like once we started building things one after the other, so some chef would come in and like do a recording, and eventually enough of the Bombay chefs came in, like, and then all the chefs seen Bombay.
There's some
started.
Momentum. Hey, it works.
Yeah, so that momentum started like reaching people like Sri, and like even like Chef Sri. If you ask him, the first time we met, I told him all of this. And like, I don't think so, man.
Well, and I mean, you know, it's the same way, right? You have to sample it, you have to tweak it, and you know, there is a layer of trust that you have to build with that,
yeah.
but I imagine that it's harder to build a layer of trust with things that are not human in that way, or data. You know, you're
Correct.
Sort of banking on data driving this,
Correct.
As opposed to the, you know, kind of human hand or your grandmother's hand or
exactly.
you know, a trusted chef's hand.
Exactly. So at the heart of it, what we end up saying is also that we are codifying this hand
yeah.
using data.
Yeah.
And the problem that we were facing initially when we were talking about this to chefs was, again, like chefs were apprehensive, but then it got to a point where almost every chef who would come in and do a test recording of a recipe, they would see their recreations like being started within the like within 4 minutes, 5 minutes of when they stopped cooking.
Wow.
And we've done, like at this point, we've done like various experiments where we got a chef to cook a recipe once. We recreated that recipe. We got the chef to make that same recipe again, and we asked them to see which one is the odd one out. And it is, and it was always like it is. I think, except for like one chef in the last 5 months, I think everybody who has recorded a recipe hasn't been able to. I mean, to the extent that they always take their second version as the odd one out as compared to the recording and recreation. And that immediately builds trust because that is a level of execution that they have not seen in any traditional mode of operation. Because if you look at what the training process looks like for their kitchen, it is the chef making the recipe, it is training staff for like weeks on end, and then
And I'm wondering, you know, it makes me think of when you go through that process and you see the kind of staggering results, and if I think a little bit about what's going on right now with generative AI, being able to iteratively learn and produce very rapidly, it is, do chefs, do consumers, do business leaders, I mean, there's an element of awe to that, mm-hmm. and inspiration to that. There's also an element of threat mm-hmm. To that too. Where does the feeling of threat come in? I mean, I imagine that if someone were to see this as a chef, as a creator, mm-hmm. and see that, you know, perhaps the generative learning is making something perhaps even better than what I can make, mm-hmm. there must be some threat involved to that too, or at least some shock.
So we actually spend a ton of time around AI. I mean, like around half of my time goes behind AI stuff. One of my co-founders also spends a substantial amount of his time, just largely because there's a lot of AI involved in like all this decision making that you do. We also have some of these learning efforts going within our thing as well. But given all of that, I don't think it's a threat to a chef. So how we look at it is, with all the generative recipes, so like I said, like there are as many recipes as atoms in the universe. We've uncovered a few million recipes of that as humanity ever. Yeah. Maybe a few hundred million as undocumented and lost and whatnot.
Right.
But that's the extent of the exploration we have done to this space as all of humanity.
Yeah.
Now, what our bet is that our bet with AI is that it will accelerate the space, and hopefully we'll be able to like find recipes that we would have taken another 300-400 years to discover.
Imagine, yeah.
It will accelerate that process, but in that acceleration process, it's the chefs who are going to get accelerated, because for any recipe that an AI generates, there are unique insights that chefs have that they can use for either like personalization or like self-expression that consumers still want to see. I mean, like another example to this is chess playing AI.
Yeah.
There is no human that can beat a chess playing AI today.
Right.
But when is the last time you've seen an AI versus AI chess match?
Right. Yeah. There's no fun in that. Right.
Yeah. So chefs as artists are, I don't think that category is going to go down.
Yeah.
I think if anything, that is going to go up. Because, see, with all the generative media and all the new content and digital experiences that get enabled for us as consumers, there will be lesser and lesser offline human touch points that we have. That and restaurants are possibly the only place where like hospitality happens at scale.
Right, right.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Nikhil Abraham. Stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Hi there. Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and let's rejoin our conversation now with co-founder and CEO of Cloud Chef, Nikhil Abraham.
I guess one of the things that I imagine, you know, there's so much attention right now to understanding and sifting through whether or not this has been, you know, an essay or a piece of writing has been produced by a bot versus mm-hmm. somebody that's human. I mean, in the end, will we have to have some kind of chat or a CAPTCHA that mm-hmm. separates out the kind of artificially created one versus the chef created one?
Well, I think that's going to be extremely hard.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be an even more harder problem with food than it is with writing, because with writing you can like abstract out people's features. You typically have like a host of content from them from before that you can use yeah. to. With food, my hunch is it's going to be harder.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's very hard. Like IP is very tricky in food to start with.
Intellectual property, sure.
So intellectual property, like who owns what recipe? Like,
yeah.
Is there an owner for
samosa?
Yeah, for samosa.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go deep enough back in history, you'll probably find the first person who made a samosa. But people will have their adaptations of a samosa. I think most of the plagiarism, intellectual property stuff will be more apparent on the branding
yeah.
of the recipes and how the story is told. Now, if you have the exact same recipe with the exact same story told, probably you can find out that's
sure.
plagiarism.
Sure.
But to what degree people will do it, I am more hopeful for the fact that with all the AI stuff that's going to unfold over the next few months, it will be even more incentive to be different than to be same.
Sure.
So as long as we can have this larger structure of being incentivized to be different
yeah.
as compared to being same.
And almost allow for the licensure and the agency to, you know, actually accept that and embrace that.
Correct.
Is that where, you know, in this way, is there a role still then for instinct and, you know, intuition and even irrationality with
mm-hmm.
these kinds of things for food choices and experiences? And if there is, then will Cloud Chef as a marketplace be a source for seeking out sometimes that irrationality, that instinct? You know, how does that fit in?
So the irrationality
and I'll give you an example of this real quick. Tree told me a story once about how he was making some dish and he wanted to use a pickle for something, and that's the traditional way to make it, but he wanted to use it trying to use a plum.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, why not? I'm making this California Indian cuisine.
Yeah.
And you know, that it's irrational to somebody else who tastes it from a classic standpoint. But for him, it's quite rational. I mean, that irrationality is now the creative process.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can never rationalize art.
Right.
And art is, to my previous point, like, recipes are art. Coming up with recipes is art. It is a very tough creative process
yeah.
that, I mean, which is like any other creative process where you could be irrational, where you just have to, like, try out a bunch of things,
yeah.
fail. Maybe, like, you'll have days of not... Have, like you have sometimes you'll have a blank slate problems. I think some of this actually AI solves, wherein if someone like a Sri has a blank slate problem, like
okay.
here's a bunch of ideas that you can bounce, start off of.
Sure.
And if they're in like hard creation mode, you should let the individual like go free and like
yeah.
do your thing and like
yeah.
But I don't think there is that much, again, like this is more of a personal opinion, I don't think there is that much of a room for irrationality in the recreation process.
Sure.
And if there is any irrationality that is required there, it is better to have that irrationality be programmatic than it being chaos on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah. One final thought. And we started out by talking about art and creation and purity in that way, but in this process so far of trying to launching a company and going through this, particularly in an area where there isn't a whole lot of a playbook already for this, what has this Cloud Chef journey so far taught you about yourself? but particularly about yourself when it comes to trusting and instinct and irrationality, not just for you as a founder, but you know, in building trust with consumers and investors and other folks and stuff.
So being a founder actually gets you to take a step back and think of yourself from the outside,
yeah,
and not just from the inside, which
right.
which is something that I honestly have never done before starting
yeah.
the company.
Yeah.
And if I think about it, there wasn't a real reason for me to do it. I mean, when you start a company, you're starting with like nothing. Like, you have to convince a bunch of people. Initially, you have to convince a bunch of people, whether it be the first set of people who you're going to work with, the first set of people who are going to give you money. Like, you have nothing. You have no progress. You
yeah.
basically have an idea. I really like the name of the podcast, Trust Me, and What I'm Doing, because it actually brings me back to the very early days of Cloud Chef, where we had nothing to show. Right now, at least, if we interact with somebody, we'll host them at our kitchen, we'll show them how all this cool tech works, we'll feed them some food. I mean, like, we have more ammunition on our...
it's not completely blank.
Yeah, at this point, as compared to when we started. And initially, we would actually give in to some of the ideas that were imposed on us. And I think the biggest thing that I kind of learned across this way is that eloquence is not directly correlated to excellence.
Sure.
So a lot of people know how to articulate points really well, but when it comes to actually doing things on the ground, only a fraction of those people
can
know
execute.
How to execute.
Yeah.
Which has two problems. One, if you focus too much on that aspect, what ends up happening is it's the people who have the coolest sounding ideas that get to build stuff as compared to the ideas that actually work. And we give others more of a benefit of the doubt as compared to trusting in ourselves initially, was that some people were able to articulate what we were doing better than we could when we initially started. And we thought that is the ground truth and that's how things are. But then when you sift through it and you waste some time and you figure out, oh shit, what I thought initially or what we as a team thought initially was in fact
the right thing.
We either didn't have the right language or we didn't have enough trust with the other person to inspire them to move on this hypothesis as compared to something else. What that has taught me, however, is every time now a situation like that arises where I'm very confident that something is true, or my instinct is that this is definitely wrong, but somebody is explaining it in a way that makes it feel like, oh, this is the most convincing thing in the world. On instances where I don't really have a good answer to that, I pause.
Mm-hmm.
And in instances where I kind of have a half-formed answer to that, it's usually then talking to that person, engaging in this dialogue to understand why I feel this way.
Yeah.
Because if they can articulate your problem better than you do. Because in most cases, when you're building something, you're too in the weeds of what you're building that you kind of
yeah.
use terminology that only a select few people
right.
who are working on the problem
yeah.
Identify with. Because that's the people that you spend the most amount of your time with. And over time, like even like investors in your company start coming into that middle ground where they also recognize some of that language.
Yeah.
So when you talk to like people completely outside
yeah.
our like sphere of influence, whether it's people who are looking at hiring us, trusting my experience, figuring out why I feel something a certain way, or why my instinct is so far on the other side when all the logic is to this side. Instead of hiding that, or instead of ignoring that, proactively diving into it
yeah.
and tearing it apart and understanding why I feel that way is also like a big accelerant to
yeah.
the learning process. I mean,
yeah.
otherwise you would have learned that same thing after making the mistake 7 months from then or like 8 months from then. Whereas if you dive into it, and the thing is, like, counterintuitively, most people don't do this. Like I didn't do this. Yeah. Like I had a company before this. Sure. I've not done it that much there.
Yeah.
I've not done it that much with the music either. Although, I mean, like, the people who are really good at making music obviously
right.
do this.
They do this well. But more than anything else, I think it's that patience, it's that learning process, it's the ability to step back. And more than, I hope more than all, it's the patience that, and in some ways the excitement that people will have for this very fascinating idea. Nikhil, thank you so much for joining us. This was a real treat, and I hope we can visit with you again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful. It was a treat to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Nikhil. And you can go to cloudchef.co to learn more. And by the way, you can recreate the magic of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing by sharing the podcast with your friends and helping rate and review wherever you might be listening. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.